will back up star quarterback Mark Sanchez in the Jets, but he dismisses pundit concerns about how Sanchez will handle that relationship.
A quarterback has to be mentally tough, and the Jets said to Mark Sanchez, "You're our guy," when they offered him a $40 million extension. So there are ways to incorporate Tim Tebow's skill without disrupting everything else that the Jets have going on.
That's NPR's Mike Pesca, who also says Tebow has a big chance to help the Jets win, bringing more power to their defensive and offensive games. Murray Lender of Lender's Bagels has died. Lender and his two sons helped to turn a small Connecticut family bakery into a nationally known brand that introduced bagels to millions of Americans. He was 81 and had suffered a fall. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Principal Financial Group, managing investments and working to help build dreams for more than 130 years. The Principal at dreamagain.com.
This fall, visit England and Wales, locations made famous in Last of the Summer Wine, Downton Abbey, and more, including Agatha Christie's home on the coast of South Devon. Does American history suit you? Well, travel in private vintage train cars on our Civil War train. This September's itinerary includes important southern battlefields and discussions with historian Anthony Pitch. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. This morning, both programs are coming from the Focus archives. We have one from March and one from January. So that means that you will not be able to call in. We'll also have some archives tomorrow. Then we'll be back and we'll be doing shows next week. And if you'd like to check the schedule, you can go to the website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. In this first hour, you'll hear a program we first broadcast on January 30th. And in this hour, we'll not be taking calls. Well, I'm very pleased to be talking this morning with Ezra Vogel. He is one of the country's best-known scholars of East Asia. He is Henry Ford II Professor of the Social Sciences Emeritus at Harvard University and has written extensively on Japan, China, on relations between East Asia and the United States. He's been at Harvard since 1964. Has written over his career many articles and a number of important books. I think a lot of people will know him for a book that he wrote, was published in 1979. That book, Japan is Number One, Lessons for America, was quite an influential book, a big bestseller in the United States and also in Japan. He revisited that subject with his 2000 book, Is Japan Still Number One? And I also do want to mention his most recent that we will be talking about. That's a book that's all about the Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping. It's a major biography of Deng Xiaoping. And the book is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. And it was published last fall by Belknap Press of the Harvard University Press. So that is a book that you can look at. He is visiting our campus. We'll be giving a talk. We are recording this interview, so we don't have the ability to take calls as we usually do in this part of the show, but I hope that people will enjoy listening to the conversation. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
I thought that it would be interesting to talk, to go back a little bit.
Sure.
And to talk a little bit about Japan and about what was going on in Japan. This would have been, say, early to mid 1970s when you were there. What was it that you were seeing that then led you to write Japan is Number One?
It was really more than what I just saw at that point. Mm-hmm. I had been there 58 to 60. I had visited Japan at least once a year since that time. But in 75 to 76, I was there for a full year. And I began to think about the changes that had taken place since 1958-60 and 1975-76. Mm-hmm. And as I thought about it, it was astonishing. At that time, no other country had grown nearly as rapidly as Japan, and I had seen extraordinary changes. And my wife and I had the good fortune of doing a family study and of forming intensive relations with a small number of families. So we had followed those families each year, and we could see them and what was happening in Japan. And I could see on that trajectory Japan was going to be a rival of the United States economically by the 1980s, and I felt I had to do my part to help wake Americans up to that change. Mm-hmm.
And it certainly turned out that you were correct, and I think many people thought that you were more farsighted, I guess, than a lot of people, because the book was published a little bit before the Japanese economy really took off.
Exactly. In 1979, when the book came out, I think the typical reaction was, it's sort of interesting, but that professor spent a little too long in East Asia, and he's been taken away. But about a decade later, people thought, wow, that guy got it right, and he saw it earlier. 3 decades later, people said, yep, he missed the boat after all, and he exaggerated, and it turned out that it wasn't great. So it's been interesting also for me to see the changes in public attitudes about Japan, even though in many ways Japan did not change as rapidly as the public attitudes.
Yeah. I think also it's very striking that since the Japanese economy went into a fairly significant decline when the bubble burst.
Right.
There, an awful lot of ink has been spilled about how bad things are. And just recently, I think I have been reading some writing about Japan that says, well, really, if you take a look at important indicators, things like life expectancy and the strength of the currency and unemployment and generally how the economy is doing, not only is it not doing badly, but we should be doing as well. So maybe 2 questions, just to talk a little bit about Japan now. What do you think, if you're assessing the strength of the country, what's important to look at?
One has to look at the politics, and politics are not doing well. I think the key reason is when the Cold War broke down, the Japanese political system fell apart. The Japanese political system that took place after, that came into place after World War I, was what people call one and a half party. You had a mainstream liberal democratic party, and then you had the leftist parties, communists and socialists. But when socialism and communism fell apart in Eastern Europe and Russia, the Japanese Communist Party and Socialist Party also basically fell apart and lost their support, particularly the Socialist Party. That meant that the glue that held the Liberal Democratic Party together and that meant coordinated leadership up until around 1990 fell apart, and it's been very hard to put Humpty Dumpty together again. So the opposition parties have come in and coalitions have, but it's very hard for a leader to last more than a year or so. And there is a real serious problem in the lack of coherence of a vision and leadership to lead the country. Another thing to look at is sort of the basic structure of the economy. And if you look at that, Japan is still doing quite well. Before it ran into problems, about 90% of the people said they were middle class. So there were not many poor people left in the country. And living standards are still quite high in Japan. And the statistics you cited are right on. Very low crime rate, very high longevity. Foreign trade, they still export more than they import. If you think about the United States keeping touch with the competition. And the yen has become so powerful that it's about 75 yen to the dollar. And, you know, when I first went to Japan, it was 360 yen to the dollar. So that's almost 4 times or 4 or 5 times the value of the yen in 1958-60. So it's a very powerful export economy. They have very high technology, very high quality. The Shinkansen, the fast rapid train, was introduced in 1964. And since that time, there have been no deaths on that train since that time. China, you had 2 big accidents recently on their fast rail train. Yeah. And in the 47 years since that was introduced in Japan, no deaths. That's an example, I think, of the quality control that they have in Japan. And ordinary daily life in Japan is still safe, pleasant. So the Japanese people are not as excited and worried as the world tells them they should be.
Yeah. Well, given that by so many indicators, life in Japan is pretty good, and that the Japanese economy is not doing all that badly, why is it that we seem to have this idea that Japan is in such poor shape?
A lot of people measure a country's success primarily by the growth in GNP, and certainly economists do that. But that notion has affected our thinking. So it is true that since about 1990, Japan has not grown even as much as most European countries, and many years not as much as the United States. So that's sort of the main view that we have of a country. In my view, we ought to take a broader perspective about the country and look at other things besides GNP growth. And Japan had such high level of GNP and such high level of standard of living to sustain those at pretty much the 1990 levels. That's extremely high. And to have a peaceful country, they've done very well since that time.
Just to reintroduce our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last couple of minutes, I'm talking with Ezra Vogel. He is professor emeritus of social sciences at Harvard University and has written a lot about modern Japan and China, relations between the U.S. and those countries. He's visiting our campus to give a talk, and we're really pleased that he could be here. We're recording this interview, so that means in this part of the show, we're not taking calls. I'd like to go back just and talk a little bit more about Japan as number one. I think that this book was an attempt to, in part, account for how it was that this country that was so devastated by World War II had managed to not only rebuild, but have an extremely strong economy and be positioned to be one of the world's major economies. So how is it in a relatively short period of time? Just a couple of decades we're talking about that happened. And you looked at a number of things in the book. You looked at the Japanese education system. You looked at how corporations were structured and the relationship between business and government and the relationship between management and workers all sorts of things. And particularly the thing that we came to hear so much about, which was the very high level of social cohesion among Japanese people, all those sorts of things that I think then much more was written about. Are particular things there, did you think that they were most important?
I think you've got it exactly right. And, of course, one reason why they were doing so well in the post-war period is that Japan had fairly high educational levels even before. Not only did they have high-level universities, but they also had science and technology and the second tier of management. They had a lot of junior colleges where they taught all kinds of specialties that were very important. And even during the first part of World War II, they had pretty good technology. They had very high, for aerial sightings, they had very high camera quality. And they had pretty high electronic equipment. So that right after the war, when companies were given a lot of freedom to develop, companies like Sony got started based on technology that had been there during World War II. And the camera industry, which is one of the first ones to blossom after World War II, had also been able to use technology from World War II. I think that's one thing. The second thing is that they transferred the kind of centralized planning that they had done for wartime to centralized planning for growth. And they had a very intelligent, thoughtful group of bureaucrats who provided new direction, and they tried to get strategies with limited resources. Where was the next technology to take off? And they also sent lots of people to the United States, Europe also, but primarily the United States, to learn modern management, modern technology. And they brought back that and studied very carefully. In a way, they were lucky that they had the American occupation. Americans there right up till 1955. Not so much that we provided good administrative leadership, but that gave them access to lots of Americans. And they became kind of go-betweens for Japan learning about the outside world. And the Americans who were there were surprised that people they thought were the enemies were willing to be so cooperative and so concerned about building a democracy and so concerned about learning from the United States. So I think all those factors played a very key role, and a lot of management was very smart. They felt they had to introduce a lot of new technology in order to get the workers to accept that. They had, and to do the training, they would have to make sure those workers would stay. So they provided long-term guarantees and gave long-term incentives so that they would then take the time to teach all that new technology that was coming in from the outside to raise their quality. And I think that farsightedness led the company to be able to catch on to a lot of new things.
Yeah. You know, I think at the time that there was a lot written about Japanese culture and American culture in pretty simplistic terms. And the thing that got emphasized over and over again was in Japan the value of the importance of fitting in, being a member of the group. You know, there's this old saying, people have heard the saying, is the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. And contrasting that with the United States and the value that we place on individualism. Was there, do you think, too much made of that?
I think that's generally accurate. I mean, if you had to have a broad generalization about the difference, there is a difference. Of course, in America, we have a lot of group things, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, the school kids learn in soccer or football or basketball. There's importance of teamwork. And a lot of the larger companies encouraged employees to work together and develop loyalty. And in Japan, there are a lot of people who are very individualistic. But I think as a generalization, if you say, what's the main trend? The Japanese do try to fit in, and they don't try to become too individualistic. It's better if you're going to be in a company a long time, you don't want to be a thorn in somebody else's side. If you're going to have to live with these people over 20, 30 years, you don't want to alienate them by sticking out for things that's really going to annoy them and that will be a lasting problem. And I think that's still a very prominent feature of most Japanese organizations.
Mm-hmm. Well, the subtitle of the book was Lessons for America. And
yes.
So you explained that having been in Japan at the time, again, that we were talking about, you know, say the mid-1970s, that you thought there were some things that Americans at least ought to be aware of. They don't know that this was going on. And I think also, though, in the book that you, I think you write about the difficulty, maybe even the inadvisability of trying to take something from the Japanese context and trying to bring it to America. Did anything like that, do you think, actually happen?
Oh, yes. I think my purpose was, as one who could see that Japan was going to get stronger, and I could see that if we weren't prepared for Japanese rise, there was going to be a lot of fighting and a lot of upsetting, a lot of organizations weren't going to be able to make it. And I thought if I could help publicize what the Japanese are doing and give healthy lessons from Japan for the United States, that would help prepare Americans for what they were going to face. Some Americans said, but, you know, their culture is so different. How can we learn from them? My answer was simple. Yes, the culture is very different. They learned a hell of a lot from the United States. Why couldn't we turn around? And I also felt, as somebody who spent a lot of time in another culture, that some Americans are quite proud and think that we do things better than everybody else. In the late, shortly after that book came out, one of the reasons it sold so well is a number of American executives who knew about the Japanese competition were happy to give my book to their employees or their friends and say, look, this is something we better be prepared for. Mm-hmm. And things like quality control was one of the main things that American companies wanted to learn. They could see that on the average, Japan was doing better quality. They were also doing faster model change. They had a different structure, for example, in the automobile industry. They would work with their suppliers, and so the suppliers were quite ready for the next round. So they could make a model change much faster than the American company, and that made them more competitive. So we had to find some way to have that same kind of change. and also to encourage the kind of commitment to the company. There were a lot of American companies that say, all right, the Japanese have done that quite well. We've got to do something like that. Of course, we have to do it in our own way. But I think in those several ways, the quality control study in the United States really took off in the 80s. I like to think that I played a little role. Of course, I wasn't the only one, and it was primarily because American businessmen knew it was in their interest. But I like to think that I played a little role in stimulating Americans to be aware of that problem. Mm.
You know, your book, as I mentioned, it was a big bestseller in the United States. It was also a big bestseller in Japan. One of the things that I guess we know about the Japanese is they like reading about themselves, or at least they're very interested in the perception of outsiders of Japan. And certainly, it's been true of Ed Reischauer, of his books. I'm sure there are other people it was true of. And it was true of Japan as number one. Are there some ways in which that being able to reflect on themselves through the outsider's eye did something in Japan?
Well, Reischauer, who was a senior colleague of mine at Harvard, he joked that that other book ought to be required in the United States and banned in Japan. It ought to be required in the United States because there are a lot of things that Japan was doing well that we ought to all know about. Mm. It ought to be banned in Japan because they would get too proud and too arrogant. There was one article in a major Japanese newspaper called it the Vogel Plot. What was the Vogel Plot? Was to make Japanese too self-confident so they would stop working and improving themselves and be too self-satisfied. But I think the timing of my book was spot on. In terms, not that I intended or was clever enough to do this, but it was just at a time when Japanese were beginning to feel self-confident. And they had so looked up so much to the United States and were so far behind, and everything they were doing was not as good as the West. There was a very strong mood in the early part of the 70s. And they were getting to be quite successful in international markets. And they were just beginning to think, wait, there are a lot of things that we do that aren't so bad that maybe we ought to try to keep. And just at that time, they could say, oh, some Harvard professor said this. We weren't the one who said we were good, but some Harvard professor said X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. So it came just at a time when the self-confidence was beginning to come out. So I think the reason it became such a bestseller in China, of course, from the great value of the book and the wisdom. In addition to that, it was that the Japanese themselves were just beginning to feel more confident. And here was some foreign professor who helped explain why and gave voice to things that they themselves begin to feel.
Yeah. Maybe one other question to ask about Japan, and then we'll move on and talk some about China. But it is certainly as it seemed that as Japan and particularly the Japanese economy got stronger and stronger, there certainly was this greater and greater feeling of confidence in the Japanese. And I think perhaps some pushback against the power of the United States. And, for example, I know this has been some time ago, but there was a very famous book written in Japan. The title was something to the effect of the Japan that can say no, where some Japanese were really saying that we're not going to take a back seat to anybody, and particularly not the United States. And if the United States thinks they're going to come over here and dictate economic or policy or our foreign policy or any other policy, they got another thing coming. So with our peaks and valleys of the economy, I'm sure there'll be peaks and valleys of the relationship between the two countries. Where now, what do the Japanese think about the United States now?
I think the Japanese in recent years have had more self-doubts since their growth slowed down and since their politics is in such a mess. Mm-hmm. I think they have a lot more self-doubts as to what they're doing. They look at America and they say, yeah, we've made a lot of mistakes too. So it's a much more complex analysis now of the whole world. To oversimplify, I think in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, America was doing so many things right, was so powerful, there's so much we got to learn. Then the 1980s, you know, do we still have to study the United States and we can say no? That was the new mood. Hmm. But I think since the bubble burst, there is a feeling that you know, we have real problems. And so there are many more different voices in Japan, and particularly they don't know quite what to do about the politics changing. They really need something different. And they also feel now, after the earthquake and tsunami and the nuclear explosions, that they've made some serious government mistakes. And what went wrong and why and what can we do about it? Mm. So there's a lot of self-doubt in Japan right now.
Yeah. Well, maybe just to pick up on that point, I just happened to be talking with somebody about that very issue, about the tsunami and what happened afterwards, and particularly what that says about the relationship between government and industry, and whether there has been too much cooperation, there too much lack of oversight, and are there people now in Japan who say, "Well, you see, this is the price that is paid."
There are some people in Japan who recognize what foreigners said, and that is that in some ways there's more social cohesion in response to the earthquake and the tsunami than would be true in many other countries. Mm-hmm. If you compare it with Haiti or Vietnam or Chile or some other country where they've had similar natural disasters, the Japanese social cohesion response, I think most people who worked on those things say, is far superior. But the nuclear explosion particularly led to questions about lack of government regulations, lack of government openness, secrecy when problems arose, effort to keep information from the public. One thing that's growing up right now after that is civilian institutions evaluating the level of radioactivity. The government was releasing things and people had doubts. So specialists in the civilian sector began publishing blogs now. So there's a great popularity now of blogs of independent scientists who are publishing information about nuclear because they don't have confidence in the government anymore.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us this morning, and also very happy to be having the opportunity to speak with Ezra Vogel. He's Emeritus Professor of Social Sciences at Harvard University, has written a lot about Japan and China, has been at Harvard since the early, mid-1960s, has written many books and mentioned a couple of times one that a lot of people will still remember. Japan is Number One, Lessons for America, published in 1979. He has a brand new book, which is about China, and we'll go on and talk about that. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk about both about Japan and China and about his new book that was published last fall. That's a biography of the Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping. That book is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China, published last fall by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. By the way, I just want to mention again, we're recording this interview. It's not live as we usually are, so we're not able to take calls this morning. Well, I know that you have said that you felt, or maybe at least you hoped, that Japan is Number One would play a role in educating Americans about Japan, and that your hope with this most recent book
exactly
would do the same thing.
Exactly. In looking at the American public, I was deciding in the year 2000 to retire. I was turning 70, and I was trying to think about what I wanted to do when I grew up. And I decided that my role after Japan's demo was to try to help educate Americans. I think those of us who have been at good universities and had that opportunity have responsibility not only to our own students but to the general public. We received Fulbright grants and National Defense Education Act, and we get foundation money. And we therefore have a broader responsibility than just our own students. And I felt that what can I help Americans understand? And, of course, it's China now. It's not Japan. I think that's the rise of China is something that we need to be prepared for. And I didn't need a shocking title like I used in 1979. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to say China's rising or China's going to be number one. People knew China was going to be strong. What I could help do, perhaps, was understand what's going on. And as I thought about that, I thought the turning point of how China turned the corner from the Maoist era into the period which has continued since 1978 of opening up to the outside world, introducing reforms. And if I could understand how that thinking took place and what shape it took, that would perhaps help Americans understand about China. And the guy that led that was Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah.
So for the last 10 years, I've been running all over everywhere, spending all my time and energy trying to understand how that era took place.
And you've made what's a pretty big statement, in fact, about Deng Xiaoping, that of all of the world leaders of the 20th century, the guy who has had the most impact on the 21st is Deng Xiaoping.
I believe that. And if you think of it in two ways, how many hundreds of millions of people did somebody bring out of poverty and lead to live normal lives? There's no question that was, Deng did more. They've raised, since he took over in 78, the route that he established was from opening up, growing, raising the standard of living. If you ask what's the shape of the global structure now, maybe it went from the Cold War of Russia against the United States to a period of kind of unipolar American power. And I think now it's clear that the next few decades is going to be the United States working with China. So what was the most fundamental change that brought about that, the rise of China? And the guy that led it and brought that about was Deng. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of shaping the way things are turning out in the 21st century, there's no single leader who had more influence on that new structure than Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah.
I really believe that.
Yeah. Well, if you read the history of modern China, there are a handful of names that are going to loom large. Mao Zedong is probably going to be the one that's largest. But next to him, probably, the other guy is going to be Deng Xiaoping. Do a little contrasting of those two men, because they were really different.
In my view, it's the other way around. I think in long run, Deng Xiaoping
Deng number one,
and Mao number two. Mao unified the country. He had never been abroad. He was a revolutionary, and he never really made the transition from being a revolutionary to establishing a new pattern that China would follow in the future. And the man that turned China around and led to the establishment of the new structure was Deng Xiaoping. Mm-hmm. And Mao, after he took power in 1980, he won the Civil War. He led that. He made huge mistakes. And the Great Leap Forward, some people estimate 30, 40 million people died. The Cultural Revolution, which split the country into part to try to keep the revolutionary going, was a disaster. And so the Chinese turned their back on that policy in 1976, as soon as Mao died. And the guy that led him in the new direction that China is following, and I think will continue to follow in the future, is Deng Xiaoping. So I think that there ought to be a new look at history, and I think there will be. I think that because of the Tiananmen incident in 1989, that Deng put down those people, and therefore so many people in China and the West thought of Deng as the terrible person who put that down. And that's true. He did. But I think if you step back and say, what's the historical impact of his era? He was the guy that started reform and opening. Sure, 700 people were killed in Beijing. But how does that compare with 30, 40 million that died under Mao? And what's the historical role? He established the new patterns.
Mm. So if you look at his life, it seems particularly striking, as you say, that he, much more than Mao, had life experience outside of China.
Beginning Absolutely.
When he was just a teenager, he went to Europe, and that was something, having lived in Europe, is having spent time in Soviet Union, somehow changed his view of the world.
You're exactly right. And Mao, unfortunately, had had no foreign experience, had never been abroad before 1949. He was far too insular. He had no idea what was going on the outside and what you had to do to make the experience of foreign countries work. Deng was 16 when he went to France, spent 5 years there, worked in lots of factories, worked in offices, and he's a very perceptive person, went around. It wasn't that he was able to go to the universities. his experience came from real life and just from thinking about it and from meeting with other Chinese who were in France at the same time, who had collectively a broad range of experiences, and thinking about what they needed to do to bring back what they needed to bring back to China to make it a strong and modern country. So he had had a lot of experience. He spent a year in the Soviet Union. In the year in the Soviet Union, Soviet Union had a policy called the New Economic Policy. That was before Stalin led the socialist transformation. And in that new economic policy, you had the Communist Party in charge, but you had a market economy. You had an international investment, and the policy was to bring in those foreign investments as much as you could and to encourage a lot of free market economy. That was Deng's experience in the Soviet Union. So when he came to power in 1978, it was easy to say, okay, we can run a country and have Communist Party in charge and yet have free market economy open to the outside world. He had that experience. Mao had never seen that experience. So I think those two experiences in France and the Soviet Union continued to influence Deng's thinking.
Yeah. At the time when the Chinese Revolution was young, or maybe even before it happened, when the people that were involved were young, they were coming from an agricultural country,
right,
to a place where they were looking at revolution that had happened in an industrialized country.
Right.
Did they recognize what was going on and immediately say, well, yes, there's a fundamental difference in the base of the economy here, but that doesn't mean we can't take what we're seeing here in the European context and bring it into the Chinese context?
I think what they felt was, in the periods when they were making the revolution from about 1927 up to 49, that 80% of the country was rural. If we're going to build a movement to overthrow the government, we're going to have the cooperation of 80% of the rural people. So the revolution, in a sense, was led by those rural people. But after they came to power, they thought that what we need to make China modern is an industrial country. So they went to the Soviet Union. They felt that Soviet Union had done a lot to introduce new industry. And in the 1950s, they tried to learn from the Soviet Union what made a modern industrial country. And they did learn a certain amount from the Soviets. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Ezra Vogel. I'd just like to introduce again for anybody who has just tuned in. He's professor of social sciences emeritus at Harvard University, has been at Harvard for a long time, has written a lot about Japan and China. His newest book is a biography of Deng Xiaoping. It's titled Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. It was published last fall. Belknap Press of Harvard University Press is the publisher. He's visiting the campus. We're happy to have him here. We're recording this interview, so that means in this hour of the show, I will not be taking calls. It's interesting that Deng Xiaoping was in important positions of power at a couple of key turning points in the relations between China and Russia, when things went sour and when it was repaired.
You've read my book very carefully. I'm delighted to have such an interviewer.
Well, let's talk about his involvement in the breakup first.
In the late 1950s, Mao Zedong was getting sick of the pressure from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union wanted to build up a communist party structure that they would be in charge of, and they would help defend China, and China would subordinate itself to the Soviet Union. By about 1959, Mao had had all he could take of that and was ready to begin attacking the Soviet Union. In terms of the discussions against the Soviet Union, he relied very heavily on Deng Xiaoping. In 1957, when Mao visited the Soviet Union, Deng was the guy who carried on the main arguments with the Soviet leaders. He'd spent a year there. He's a smart guy. He knew the arguments, and he was a very strong supporter of Mao at that time. And so Mao was very happy with that. In the early 1960s, the China and the Soviet Union exchanged a series of 9 letters attacking each other and going into great detail. Mao put Deng in charge of those letters. In 1963, to cap all this off, he sent Deng Xiaoping to Moscow to carry on the debates with Syslov, the Soviet ideological leader, and they debated and fought, and then relations, you know, were basically cut off after 63. When Deng came to power in 78, he felt that in order to modernize China, they had to have good relations with the outside world. The Soviet Union made a mistake by putting so much in the military that they exhausted themselves, and it didn't improve the lives of the Soviet people. And that to keep power in China and for the good of China, they needed to have a plan that where people could get richer in China. So he didn't want that. And he tried to form peaceful relations with the Soviet Union. In the early 1980s, he said, three conditions get our back in relations with China, the Soviet Union back to normal. One, they got to pull a lot of their troops away from Outer Mongolia, the million troops pressing on the Chinese borders. Two, they have to get out of Afghanistan. That, of course, is an interesting thing to say at this point in our own history. Third, that the Soviet ally Vietnam had to pull troops out of Cambodia. In 1989, Gorbachev was ready to come back to China on Deng's conditions, and Deng welcomed him back. So from 1963, when Deng attacked the Soviet Union, they split. Until 1989, 26 years, they had terrible relations. In 89, they didn't revive the close relationship of the 50s, but they normalized relations, and they greatly reduced the tensions, and that was under Deng Xiaoping.
In his career, in Deng's career, he had two major reversals, criticisms, periods when he was on the outs. He was sent down.
Right.
But then he was rehabilitated, and this happened twice. And
it happened three times. Once,
well, that's true. Even
way back in the 30s. But twice under Mao.
I'm thinking about that period and under Mao. And, you know, the idea that somebody would come back from this once, well, not every – that people – get sent down and never come back. But this man actually managed to come back twice. Now, I guess the second time was really right about the time that Mao died. And then that was when he took over the position of leadership. But I think what you have said, though, what's maybe important as you look at the relationship between these two men, is that Mao never put Deng down so far and so hard that he couldn't come back.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
What then did Mao see in Deng?
Well, the very first time that Deng was purged, way back in the 30s, what he was criticized for was being leader of the Mao faction. He strongly supported Mao in the very early days. And even though Deng had worked with Zhou Enlai, the person really responsible for his rise was Mao. And Deng was absolutely dedicated in serving Mao. From the early 1930s right up through 1959, when Deng could see how Mao fouled up in the Great Leap Forward, I think he began to pull back within the realm of what he could do. But Mao, he had proved such loyalty to Mao over the years and was so capable that Mao distinguished between him and the other high-level leader, Liu Shaoqi, who was purged in the Cultural Revolution. Deng, he felt, you bop him down, you teach him some lessons, send him down, and then maybe you can use him again. So he never destroyed Deng the way he destroyed Liu Shaoqi and some other leaders.
There in the political career of Nikita Khrushchev, one of the key moments was a speech that he gave. It was to a closed session of the party leadership in which he delivered a stinging rebuke of Stalin. Now, this was several years after Stalin was dead, so perhaps Khrushchev felt at the point it was safe enough to be doing that. But it was a pretty big thing nonetheless. And I don't think anything like that ever happened, even though I'm sure people had bad feelings about Mao. Nothing like that ever happened in China.
You've come right to the key point. In 1956, at the 20th Party Congress, Khrushchev devastated Stalin, and such a terrible criticism that anybody who worked with Stalin was blackened by that because they were too close to him. And all the Soviet leaders had worked with Stalin. So it was just devastating to the authority of the party. At that 20th Party Congress, Dunn was in attendance, and he could see what was happening. And immediately he could see the impact on the party, and he felt that no matter how bad the Chinese leader ever got, he should never be criticized because it would destroy, in the same way, because it would destroy the authority of the party. So he was very determined when Mao died, even though there was a lot of criticism of Mao, that they not devastate Mao the same way that they had devastated Stalin and the Soviet Union.
When Deng came back, I guess it would be the third time, he seemed to take on, as his brief, education, science, and technology.
Right.
Those are the things that he thought
right.
was, of all the things that he could personally,
exactly.
those were the things.
Exactly.
Because he thought that, the painful truth of the time was that China was way behind the West, and if it was going to modernize, those are the things that they had
absolutely.
To work on.
Right.
Talk some more about that.
Deng's wife in the 1930s had not only attended high school but attended the university. She studied physics. Deng had five kids. Three of them studied physics at Peking University. And one had studied medicine. One whose physique was weak, not able to take the stuff, studied science, music and art. I think that gives some indication how important he felt science and technology was. So in 77, when he began to come back under Hua Guofeng, he made science and technology his main cause. And one of the ways he went about this was seeing the Nobel Prize winners in the United States who were Chinese Americans, because they knew world science. They were at the top of the field. They had been in China in the late 40s. They could speak to Deng in Chinese, and they knew the situation in China. So Deng could jumpstart China's science by talking to them and other technicians who had been abroad. They were very lucky that they had so many Chinese Americans, Chinese Europeans, who were skilled in science and technology. And Deng really felt of the four modernizations, science, technology is the most important. And so he really pushed for that field. It was, in his view, the underpinning to modernization.
I'm sure that he would have expected that if that could be accomplished, that the living standards of people would rise. That
absolutely.
The country would become stronger economically, certainly. Did he not think, though, that if you did that, that somehow political, economic, particularly political reforms would somehow naturally have to follow because people would start wanting that?
He was not necessarily against political reforms. In Moscow in 1927, he wrote an article and he said, the political situation in the country, including how much democracy a country has, depends on the political situation. And in 1978, when he came to power, some people started to write on a wall independent views. Mm-hmm. And it came to be known as Democracy Wall. He supported that very strongly for 3 or 4 months until he felt it was getting out of hand. And then he felt there were too many criticisms of the Communist Party and the place might fall apart. And we had to put some limits on this. In 1980, he gave a famous speech in August, which he said we need political reform. He tried to lay it out. In 1986, he sponsored a whole series of meetings led by Zhao Ziyang in which he tried to consider political reform. So he was not necessarily worried about political form. What he was worried about is that people would try to introduce it too quickly, and the people who opposed the government would take advantage of leniency to cause all kinds of disruptions and the government falling apart. I think in the United States, we don't have to worry that people who disagree with us are going to overthrow our government. But in China, which has had disasters since the Opium War and had a hard time uniting, there's a lot of, and it's 1.3 billion people, even now several hundred million and below the poverty lines. They're really worried that people could demonstrate, and they're more concerned. And Deng, as the top leader, felt the responsibility of trying to keep that order. even if he had to be a tough. And he'd been a soldier for 12 years, and he didn't hesitate to be tough when he thought it was needed.
Well, that and the thing, as you discussed a little earlier, the thing often people will think about and will want to criticize him for is his response to the pro-democracy demonstrations in Tiananmen and the crackdown there. Do you think that, did he actually think that that, what was going on there was a threat to the country?
Yes, he did. And at first, when people started demonstrating, this was in April, after the death of Hu Yaobang, he allowed it to go on. He didn't crack down immediately. Then he began to worry, and he began to warn people. Then after Gorbachev left, and while Gorbachev was there, he didn't want to embarrass himself in front of the world cameras. After Gorbachev left, he ordered martial law and the troops to come in. He ordered them to come in unarmed and not to shoot. And on May 20th, they came in. But there was so much opposition to the troops among people who didn't want troops coming in and from remembering the problems from the Red Guards and also very concerned about their own inflation. The prices were going up and their salaries were not going up. So there were a lot of adults who supported the students. And when that got out of hand, the effort to have martial law without shooting failed. Mm-hmm. The trucks were stopped, and as soon as they stopped the trucks, they let the air out of the tire, and so they weren't able to gain control. And Deng Xiaoping told the troops to withdraw, brought in reinforcements, and then on June 3rd said, do what you have to do to keep order. Mm-hmm. And that meant it included shooting anybody who resisted, who stood in the way. And it was not just Deng. He made the final decision. But most of the other leaders also felt that something had to be done. And they saw Eastern Europe falling apart. So Union falling apart, they were afraid that would happen in China.
So much more we could talk about. I'm sorry we're at the end of the time. We're just going to have to leave it at that. Certainly, I would suggest to people, if you'd like to read more about modern China, and
buy my
Deng
book.
Xiaoping, buy the book, Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of Modern China and the Transformation of China, published last fall, Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Our guest, Ez Vogel, is Professor Emeritus of Social Sciences at Harvard. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And the program you've been listening to was first broadcast on January 30th when Ezra Vogel was visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. Many past programs are available on our web archive. You can listen to those shows, and you can also check up on the schedule for the days and weeks ahead. All of that is available on our website. That's wyll.illinois.edu. Coming up in the second hour, this is also an archive show. This is one that we first broadcast in March, and this is an interview with Alexis Madrigal. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and we were talking about his book, Powering the Dream. And this is a book that explores the history of green technology. He looks back to some of the earliest green technologies and points out that going back to the turn of the last century, that people were using the sun to heat water for their homes, and they were using wind power, and there were electric cars. And the question the book poses is, well, if this technology is demonstrated to be useful and that it does work, well, why aren't we using it? So you can hear that coming up in the next part of Focus. In the meantime, we'll take a break, as we usually do at this point, so we can bring you an update on the markets. Then we'll have some news from NPR, so stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309. WILL agricultural programs and services are made possible by the Friends of WILL and by Strategic Farm Marketing, Boulder Design, Stuart Peterson, and Pioneer Seeds. Thank you for your continued support.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. We're at mid-session. Futures still in the red for the most part, but if you are a bull, something to cheer about, as many futures grains are coming off of their lows and trimming losses that were made earlier.